ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Killed with a drug overdose, then cut up and put in a wheelie bin. That is what prosecutors allege Cherie Glastonbury did to her partner, 55-year-old Geoffrey McLean. On the case of the wheelie bin murder, we'll follow the murder trial of Cherie Glastonbury and three co-accused as they defend charges relating to Geoffrey's death. Search for the Case Law podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss an episode.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people.
One of the things that annoys me most about political press conferences is when reporters ask multi-part questions.
And I go to Beth for the final question, please. Beth.
Thank you, Prime Minister. If I could start with you.
This is Sky News' Beth Rigby in September last year asking British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and US President Donald Trump what ended up being a five-part question.
Prime Minister, President Trump has said he's ready to impose Moses sanctions. Mr. President, if I may, the King praised your personal commitment last night. Was it a mistake to invite him to Alaska? Do you regret it?
The reason this annoys me is because when one part of the question is really interesting and really needs a response, the politicians can just wriggle out of it by answering a different part of your question. In this press conference, this is the bit I wish she'd focused on.
Finally, if I may, the elephant in the room, Lord Mandelson. He is no longer the ambassador.
Lord Peter Mandelson had just been fired as the UK's ambassador to Washington.
Do you have some sympathy with him that he lost his job over historic links to Jeffrey Epstein?
Now that is a very good question. She's asking how Trump feels about someone else losing their job over links to Jeffrey Epstein, when Trump, of course, has very well-documented links to Epstein himself.
I don't know him, actually. I had heard that, and I think maybe the Prime Minister would be better speaking of that. That was a choice that he made, and I don't know. What is your answer to that?
Well, the question was specifically to you, Mr. President. But okay, how's the Prime Minister going to deal with this?
Well, I mean, it's very straightforward. Some information came to light last week which wasn't available when he was appointed, and I made a decision about it, and that's very clear. On the question of the pressure on Putin.
They quickly moved on to talking about Russia, and they never came back to the Epstein thing. That's why you don't ask five-part questions. Trump and Starmer escaped that press conference unscathed, but that elephant in the room has continued to follow them around ever since.
The fallout from the Epstein files continues to grow across continents.
According to the file, Mr. Trump said everyone knew about Epstein's behaviour.
I think it's time now for the country to maybe get onto something else.
But interestingly, while Trump and his administration are doing their best to get America onto other things, it's a very different story in the UK, where the dark Epstein cloud is settling in.
An impending cloud of doom hovers over Downing Street.
The UK Prime Minister is facing increasing pressure to step down.
This newly released trove of documents are making bigger waves at Whitehall than the White House.
In our last episode, we talked about how the groundswell that led to the release of the Epstein files is a sign that trust in institutions that are supposed to hold those in power to account is breaking down, giving way to a kind of mob justice. But in the UK, it seems to be a slightly different story. And I think looking at how this drama is playing out on each side of the Atlantic tells us a lot about the state of American and British democracy. So today, the scandal that has infected both sides of the so-called special relationship and what it's revealing about each country. I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. We're going to start this story in 2017 in the deeply conservative southern state of Alabama. Take it away, boys.
We can't take the Ten Commandments out of the Bible or my heart.
During the election campaign to fill one of Alabama's two Senate seats in 2017, the Ten Commandments were on a lot of people's minds.
Ten rules to live hereby that proclaim our Savior's word. 10 gifts from heaven to guide us here on earth.
One of the candidates, former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, had made a name for himself by insisting that the Ten Commandments be displayed in a granite monument inside the Alabama Judicial Building's rotunda. At the time, displaying the Ten Commandments in a government building was considered unconstitutional. And so,
this court hereby orders that Roy S. Moore be removed from his position of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Alabama.
His stance meant that when he began his Senate run, he got the support of some big hitters, like White House advisor Steve Bannon.
Now, Judge Moore knows that the Ten Commandments is the basis of the Judeo-Christian West.
At a political rally, Roy Moore attempted to prove how pro-gun he was by pulling a pistol out during his speech.
I believe in the Second Amendment.
I know you can't see it, but he's pulled what I would describe as a comically small gun out of his pants pocket. Oh, and he's wearing a cowboy hat. When it comes to electability, Roy Moore seemed to have it all. Ten Commandments, check. Pack and heat, check. Wearing a cowboy hat and riding on a horse to visit polling places, also check.
I think it's a good thing to do. I won the last time I rode a horse. I think maybe you have a good favor.
As a result, Moore handily won the Republican primary and was expected to easily win the general election in deep red Alabama. But as the general election approached, Roy Moore's fortunes began to change.
8 women have accused him of misconduct, mostly in the 1970s, when he was in his 30s and they were teenagers, one just 14.
One of the women, Beverly Nelson, accused Moore of sexually assaulting her when she was 16 years old, after offering to drive her home from the restaurant where she worked.
I had tears running down my face. At some point, he gave up. And he then looked at me and he told me, he said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
Mrs. Nelson said that coming forward with the allegation was not an attempt to harm the Republican Party.
"My husband and I supported Donald Trump for president. This has nothing whatsoever to do with the Republicans or the Democrats. It has everything to do with Mr. Moore's sexual assault when I was a teenager."
Historically, both major American political parties aren't super keen to be associated with people accused of sexual assault and encourage them to step aside while the allegations are investigated. As such, once these allegations came to light, establishment Republican politicians like Senate leader Mitch McConnell began urging Roy Moore to drop out of the race.
"I believe the women, yes. I think he should step aside."
President Trump, however, didn't see how allegations like this should be a barrier to getting elected. He himself had already refused to step aside when allegations were made against him during the 2016 presidential election, even while he levelled various criminal allegations at his opponent, Hillary Clinton.
"She is disqualified for running for president of the United States. She's disqualified."
He was making it clear that disqualifying allegations only applied to his opponents. When it came to his friends, like Roy Moore...
"Well, he denies it. Look, he denies it. He says it didn't happen. And, you know, you have to listen to him also."
Conservative political commentators were quick to fall in line behind Trump and began making excuses for Moore's alleged behaviour.
"We need to be asking ourselves, Joy, between Roy Moore and the accusers, who is more credible?"
"If you go back and you don't elect anyone who's ever done anything wrong, you know, we wouldn't have had Barack Obama. I think he did cocaine. Bill Clinton supposedly smoked marijuana."
"Okay. Yes, he dated girls who were 17, 19 when he was 30. We might find that a little creepy today, but this was nearly 50 years ago."
Now, I feel like a Rubicon was crossed here. Donald Trump unilaterally decided that the old way of handling allegations of this nature was not fit for purpose. The right-wing media agreed, And as for the rest of the Republicans, well, they'd just have to keep their mouth shut if they knew what was good for them.
We need somebody in that Senate seat who will vote for our Make America Great Again agenda. So get out and vote for Roy Moore.
The deal is, if you're on my side, if you can help me, it's all good in the hood. Trump had established a new norm that power should be maintained whatever the cost. Now, it didn't work for Roy Moore. He lost on Election Day, handing the Democrats their first Alabama Senate seat in decades. But Trump applied these new norms several times during his first term, and not just to political figures. When allegations of sexual assault were made against his Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, Trump was quick to jump to his defense.
This is one of the highest quality people that I've ever met. And everybody that knows him says the same thing.
Now, none of this was ever tested in court, but Kavanaugh denied the allegations under oath at a Senate Judiciary Committee, and he was later confirmed as a Supreme Court judge. So that's the new standard in Trump's America as of 2017. But would this become the new normal for political leaders elsewhere around the world when faced with inconvenient allegations? Well, conveniently for the purposes of this story, just as Roy Moore's campaign was getting derailed, the British Conservative government was facing a similar problem.
When I got to his flat, he just poured me a drink. I felt him tugging my shirt out of my trousers and giving me a back massage, which I hadn't asked for.
This is former British Olympic rower turned Conservative Party activist Alex Storey, talking to the BBC about an encounter he says he had with senior Conservative MP Chris Pincher in 2001.
Him whispering in my ear as far as he could get, you'll go far in the Conservative Party. Of course, I stood up and jokingly said, it's better perhaps if we stay friends.
So, following these allegations of inappropriate touching, Pincher stood down from his position as the party's assistant whip and referred himself for investigation. The Conservative Party decided a month later that Pincher had not breached the code of conduct and he was allowed to return to the leadership group. Over the next 5 years, he held a number of different ministerial portfolios. But then in 2022, it all spilled out into the open again.
The latest scandal is centred on this man, Chris Pincher. He's stood down as deputy Tory whip over allegations he groped two men in a private club.
Much like Roy Moore's story, the interesting part is less about the specific allegations and more about how it was handled by his political party. This was now the second time the public had been made aware of sexual misconduct allegations against Chris Pincher. There was clearly a pattern here. When allegations emerged of at least half a dozen other similar incidents, questions began to be asked about who knew what and when. Pincher's story is already diverging from Roy Moore's story. Moore was able to stay on the campaign trail with the president's backing, but in Pincher's case, association with him was politically toxic. Boris Johnson denied knowing anything about allegations before he appointed Pincher to his various senior positions. Here's Tory MP Will Quince on Sky News.
I've been given categorical assurance that the Prime Minister was not aware of any serious, specific allegation with regards to the former Deputy Chief Whip.
That line of argument only lasted a few hours.
That since emerged, Boris Johnson appointed him despite knowing of other sexual misconduct claims dating back several years.
Johnson had to face questions about whether he'd made jokes about Pincher's behaviour years earlier.
He's reported to have said, he's handsy. That's the problem. Pincher by name, Pincher by nature.
Johnson tried to wriggle his way out of it with excuses and apologies.
What I wanted was to give Chris Pincher, if not the benefit of that, then the ability to prove that he could do better. That was the wrong decision, and I bitterly regret it.
But this explanation wasn't going to cut it. Donald Trump may have been able to get away with saying, well, the guy denies it and we need his vote, but Boris Johnson isn't Donald Trump, and the UK isn't the US. Basically, Boris Johnson's entire cabinet decided to resign and called on him to resign too.
At some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough.
Miss
Mr. Speaker, isn't this the first recorded case of the sinking ships fleeing the rat?
And look, perhaps Boris Johnson may have been able to survive this scandal if he wasn't already battling about six other scandals, from having illegal parties during the COVID lockdown to allegations of lying to Parliament and the Queen.
How many more ministers need to quit before he finally picks up his pen and writes his own resignation letter?
Finally, Boris got the message.
I want you to know how sad I am to be giving up the best job in the world. But them's the breaks.
The British government's response to these allegations was not perfect, but as a result of public pressure and accountability processes, it got there in the end. Public allegations of misconduct kicked off a chain reaction that no individual member of Parliament could stop, not even Boris Johnson. The question of who knew about this and did you lie to the public mattered. And the person who should have known better lost his job.
When the herd moves, it moves. And my friends, in politics, no one is remotely indispensable.
So we've got two scandals, Chris Pincher and Roy Moore. In one, the system functioned as expected. And not only Pincher lost his job, but those who gave him that job were also turfed out. But in the case of Roy Moore, there was no institutional accountability at all. It was entirely left up to the voters to deal with it. So let's fast forward to 2026 and look at how those scandals set the scene for how institutions would react to the biggest global scandal in living memory. Let's start in the UK because, well, there's a lot going on there.
A room full of scriptwriters couldn't pen something more damaging or more improbable than this whole scandal.
A Prime Minister fighting to keep his job.
Oh, do you think Keir Starmer should resign?
Yeah, I think so.
They've been taking the piss out of everybody.
We're quite disappointed. We thought that he might be better than this.
The Epstein story reached a boiling point for the British Labour government when it was revealed that Lord Peter Mandelson, the man that Prime Minister Keir Starmer appointed as the British ambassador to the US, was a very, very close friend of Epstein.
Pictured with his pants down, Peter Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein is a major political scandal.
So, quick timeline here. Peter Mandelson held a series of senior government positions under Labour Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, including as Brown's de facto deputy prime minister in 2009 and 10. In 2024, he was nominated by the new Labour government under Sir Keir Starmer to be the US ambassador. There's no allegation that Mandelson was involved with Epstein's sexual misconduct. The scandal partially surrounds the financial relationship that Mandelson and his now husband, Reynaldo da Silva, had with Epstein.
Documents show that between 2003 and 2004, Epstein appears to have sent three separate payments of $25,000 referencing Lord Mandelson.
But the real scandal is more about what they said to each other and when. Coincidentally, or maybe not, the period when he was second in command to Gordon Brown in 2009 and 10 was the period when his relationship with Epstein was most active, according to the emails released by the US government. Jeffrey Epstein had just been released from jail after serving time for solicitation of a minor when Mandelson stayed at Epstein's house in Manhattan, and the pair started emailing each other more than once every day.
The latest tranche of Epstein files has exposed allegations that the former business secretary leaked confidential government information. One email suggests he passed on a private memo to Epstein about the possible sale of British assets. And in 2010, he appeared to give the convicted sex offender advance notice of a European bailout.
That could be considered market-sensitive information that Epstein could hypothetically have used to make a lot of money. Keir Starmer sacked Mandelson in September last year, as soon as the true extent of his relationship with Epstein started to become clear. The PM is also trying to get Mandelson kicked out of the House of Lords and is backing a police investigation. But like with Boris Johnson during the Chris Pincher scandal, the real questions are about how Mandelson got the job in the first place.
The very real question that Keir Starmer faces is, did he know more than what was in the public domain?
The people instrumental in Mandelson's hiring have been forced out. Starmer sacked the head of the British Civil Service, and his own Chief of Staff and Director of Communications have both resigned. But Starmer himself is holding on. He's indicated that he wasn't directly involved in the vetting process of Mandelson and won't be resigning, despite serious public anger.
Is time running out for you, Prime Minister?
Prime Minister, can you survive this?
Keir Starmer is under serious political threat, with his own MPs threatening mutiny. And as far as anyone can tell, neither he nor his advisers ever even met Epstein. In the UK, Epstein's not just toxic to his friends, he's toxic to their friends. And I don't want you to think that the UK is alone here. Similar things are happening right across Europe. In Norway, for example, former Prime Minister Torbjørn Jagland has been charged with aggravated corruption, and his homes have been searched based on information released in the Epstein files. Over in Germany, lawmakers are pushing for a full investigation into the files to determine if Epstein had any political or economic influence over the German government. Similar investigations are underway in France and Slovakia, where there have been high-profile resignations and sackings. You get the feeling that, for Europe at least, all of this may only just be the beginning. Meanwhile, in the United States, it's a very different story.
Trump's name also appears more times in the Epstein file than Harry Potter's name appears in the 7 books about Harry Potter.
Many elected officials, including the president, Donald Trump, are not only mentioned in the Epstein files, it's been revealed that they were close friends. But despite this, the people in the political class under the most pressure to explain their connections to Epstein are Trump's opponents, Bill and Hillary Clinton. The Epstein scandal is a rare, controlled experiment in democratic standards across various national systems. There's the same documents, same timeline, same revelations. It's a stress test for institutional accountability. In parts of Europe, mere proximity to Epstein is enough to end careers. In Donald Trump's America, if you're allied with the big boss, even being friends with Epstein right up to his death barely registers. Last week we talked about what happens when people lose trust in the systems that are meant to keep the powerful in check. The public lost trust in the justice system, and journalists took matters into their own hands and forced the release of the Epstein files. Now they're demanding accountability for what's been revealed in those files. They're demanding investigations into the people we now know were closely associated with Epstein. But in politics, accountability seems to vary depending on whether you're on the east or west side of the Atlantic. If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. It's produced by Adair Shepherd and Pat Sunderland. Supervising producer is Cara Jensen-McKinnon. Now, last week we asked if you had any questions about Jeffrey Epstein that you want us to answer, and it appears that you do have some questions. If you've got one that you would like to add, send it through, preferably as a voice message if possible, to ifyourlistening@abc.net.au. We will do our best to answer as many of those questions as possible on Tuesday. I'll catch you then.